Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas takes your calls, emails, and our questions. In case you didn't know it, tomorrow's July 4th. Are you heading to the Esplanade this year or not? We'll get a special preview from Ayla Brown, one of tomorrow night's performers with the Boston Pops. She'll belt out a tune or two for us, and then our salute to summer music, from jazz to rock to classical. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy's got another day off, and filling in ably today for Jim, who will be back on Monday, is Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and South End News.
Very
Thank
good,
you
Marjorie.
For
Thank
coming
you.
In,
Glad
Sue.
To be here again.
And we're going to start off today with our Ask the segment, and that means we have a government person here, and that person will take your questions at 877-301-8970. Our Ask the Person today is
Who is that person, Marjorie?
That person would be Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, who represents the 3rd Congressional District and serves on the Armed Services and Natural Resources Committee. Congresswoman, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Great to be here with you.
Okay, and we just went over the fact that we both spent a little bit of time at Smith College. That was kind of romantic back in the day. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. You can email us. You can call in with your questions, and will answer, or she will answer, as many as you can. We're going to talk a little bit about Afghanistan. We're going to talk about the whole thing about the terrible sexual violence against women in the military. But you have this other thing I wanted to start about, this sneaker loophole involving something that is taking away jobs to people here in America. What's the deal with the sneaker loophole, Congresswoman?
Well, there's something that's called the Berry Amendment that's been in place really since World War II, 1941. It was put in place, and it was designed to make sure that American soldiers who were risking their lives in our behalf were going to war and serving their country, primarily wearing, to the extent possible, American-made uniforms and all the supplemental gear that our soldiers need. And in 2002, a loophole was created that exempted footwear. And the thinking at the time was that there really was no American footwear company that could provide these shoes, that or that our soldiers needed choices in the footwear they were wearing, and that, you know, given the issues with some people's feet, they needed to just have the discretion to choose the shoe they wanted. And so they were given a voucher to go purchase these shoes. But as we have looked into this issue and become aware of it, we realize that there is at least two companies, actually, that now could provide American-made footwear that would adequately serve the needs of our soldiers, that there is nothing to prohibit or prevent any company from making footwear here in this country and therefore be eligible to provide footwear for soldiers. So we introduced an amendment as part of this year's National Defense Authorization Bill that essentially would eliminate that waiver and say, going forward, that our soldiers, given the fact that there is a choice now, given the fact that included in our amendment would be an exemption if you really do have problems with your feet and you need a very different kind of shoe, that you could go then and purchase them however you wished. But that, but now footwear would also need to be Berry compliant, as we call it. Berry is the name of the amendment. And it so happens that New Balance, which is a very well-regarded company here.
New Balance.
We're right next door to New Balance.
We're next to the New Balance
outlet,
right?
It if qualifies, could provide that footwear. There's a company in Michigan that could provide that footwear. And as I said, it doesn't prevent any other manufacturer from seeking to provide that footwear. So it's an important, and it's a help support, as you said, American jobs
Absolutely.
Here in this country.
You know, this seems like one of those very simple common sense issues, which I know it's more complicated than that. But, you know, one of the things I learned during the economic crisis when we got in the auto business was one of the reasons that we need to have a vibrant auto business in the United States of America is in case we need them to make things during a time of war. You know, I don't know if that's still a, you know, very solid way to go in terms of what we need. But I thought, well, that makes sense. We might need manufacturing. And why is it that we don't do an inventory? Is there an office that would do an inventory? Is there an auditor of some sort that would say, okay, this we're not buying American products that we have? It would seem like a jump start to our economy and a good idea.
Well, absolutely. I mean, coming from the Merrimack Valley,
right.
which is sort of home to manufacturing, it's where the Industrial Revolution began in this country and really changed the way we manufacture products and changed the economy of this country. So it's a part of this Commonwealth that's deeply rooted in manufacturing. And I actually held a Make It in America town hall to sort of investigate what the challenges were. New Balance actually hosted it because we also have, as much as you have a New Balance right here, mm-hmm. I have a New Balance right in Lawrence, Massachusetts. It provides jobs for many, many residents of the city in the Merrimack Valley. And, you know, one of the takeaways from it is we do manufacture much more than we think we do, mm-hmm. but it's different.
Yep.
At one point, I was living in an old mill that had converted to condominiums, and I used to lie in, you know, sleeping at night and say, could anybody who have used to work here imagine that I would now be living here? But if you walked by on the street in that era, you would know exactly what was going on inside those mills. You could hear it. You could smell it. Mm-hmm. You could feel the reverberations mm-hmm. of the machines. Manufacturing now is very different. I spend a lot of time visiting companies throughout my district just to see what they are doing. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily advanced manufacturing. It requires a whole different order of skills. But one of the things we learned at the Make It in America town hall was that we have created this mantra that we don't manufacture anymore. And as a result, young people don't think there are opportunities there, whereas the reality are there are many more opportunities than that mantra would suggest. The other thing is, obviously, because it's so highly technical, you in many instances do need advanced degrees. But it's also true, apparently, that vocational and technical schools could provide many mm-hmm. of the skill sets that are needed to help fill these jobs. And they are a good source of a decent living. So it's different now, but it doesn't mean it's gone. And I think it's really important that we support it in every way we can, whether it's through our research and development tax credits in particular, to make sure we're constantly reinventing ourselves, because that really is the challenge of our times, that as quickly as we come up with a new way to do something, somebody else has thought of another way or goes offshore. I mean, we've got to change our tax laws too mm-hmm. to encourage keeping those jobs here. But this was a way of acknowledging there are these companies that can provide these shoes.
We're talking with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. You can call in and ask her what you'd like to ask her at 877-301-8970, or you can email us at bpr@wgbh.org, and we will read as many of emails as we can. Jim Bragg's got the day off. Sue O'Connell is in for him. That's her voice you just heard along with the Congresswoman. Before we get to the calls, I have, if people don't know this, and they probably do because it's been so well publicized, this terrible problem of sexual assault in the military. I think there were 26,000 assaults just last year, and the numbers are up and up and up. And we've been hearing for decades now, I think since Tailhook in 1991, you know, Defense Secretary after Defense Secretary said, oh, no, we're not going to put up with this. And, you know, Barack Obama said he wasn't going to put up with this. But they're putting up with it because it continues to happen. You were very successful, I believe, in your legislation that would say, and this is just incredible, that a commander could overturn a jury verdict of guilty in a rape case. You filed legislation to prevent that, correct?
We did.
And what happened?
And it's now included in the defense authorization bill that has passed out of the House of Representatives.
Okay.
So what that does, for the first time in decades, actually challenge and change the powers of a commander in a sexual assault case, but actually in any case, because the reality is you have an appellate process. It's well in place. A commander should never have the authority to unilaterally overturn a jury verdict of guilty, given that there is this appellate process. So, yes, sexual assault was the driver of our really looking at this issue, but the reality is it should change across the system. And so that's an important first step.
But here's the thing that drives me nuts about this, and you should be commended because you have done great work about this. Interestingly, a lot of women in the Congress have been doing the best work on this whole issue. But to me, this is very analogous to the Catholic Church. They were going to patrol themselves. That didn't work out so well. Penn State was going to patrol themselves, where Jerry Sandusky was abusing children for years. That didn't work out. I don't believe the military can patrol itself. And there are many survivors, as you well know, Congresswoman, who think that the prosecution, which almost never happens, by the way. I mean, they have tightened up penalties for prosecution, but since no one's ever prosecuted, it almost seems to me like, is this really getting us anywhere? That prosecutions of these sexual violence cases should be taken out of the chain of command, frankly, taken out of the military altogether and go to some independent group. I wonder what you think about that, and if you think there's any possibility, it didn't get anywhere this time, of that happening.
Well, the fight isn't over, and it's what you call the disposition authority. So under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, commanders have extraordinary power. So whether it's the one we've just made the first step in changing to take away their power to overturn a jury verdict, they also have the authority, as allegations of crimes come forward, to make a decision whether or not to pursue it through the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And this is true in sexual assault. It's also true in every other crime. And what we've seen is that all too often, especially in the cases of sexual assault, they're inherently conflicted. They're usually have both the perpetrator and the survivor in their command. They don't know how to deal with these cases. They're uncomfortable with the subject matter. And the impulse has been too often is just to sweep it under the rug.
Yeah.
So as we examine this authority, you know, I'm not for it, and I'm not for changing. I'm not against it. I think we have to get it right. And in last year's defense authorization bill, we created an independent panel that has just been put together that will spend this next year looking at all of the issues under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So let's say the commander does make a decision to go ahead and pursue charges. They also have the power to choose the jury. So there are a lot of issues that mm-hmm. have to be addressed. And rather than do it piecemeal, I think we have this opportunity to take a look at the whole of it. Now, the Senate has yet to take action, and this issue will come up as they debate their bill as well. So we haven't seen the end of it yet. It's just the beginning.
Congresswoman, one of the things that struck me during this whole period, and I know that, you know, you weren't in elective office at the time, but I know that you and both your late husband have been huge supporters of the gay and lesbian community. And in fact, the first presidential campaign that many gays and lesbians were involved with openly was the late Congressman Paul Tsongas's campaign. During the hearings for Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the early 1990s, which I know you paid attention to, you know, we talked so much and heard so much about people, grown men, grown military people, talking about being afraid to be in the showers, you know, that they were going to be attacked in submarines by, you know, these roving gay men raping them in showers and in submarines. And during Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we heard a lot from female enlisted people talking about how the claim that they were lesbian was used against them if they had been sexually assaulted or had been sexually harassed. Now, here we are in 2013, and for me, looking back, it's clear now that the military was telling us they had an assault problem. They had a sexual assault problem, right?
Right.
What, you know, why else would grown men be afraid to be in the shower? They were already afraid of predators who were assaulting them, you know, because we found out in this survey that came out that the vast majority or the majority of assault people who have been assaulted were men sexually assaulted. What? How did all this? I mean, it's like the Catholic Church, as Marjorie said. How was all this information all out there, and all of us smart people just didn't hear what the military enlisted people were saying? You know, it's just so striking to me.
Well, it's clearly a crime of violence and mm-hmm. a crime of power.
Right.
And as you say, the raw numbers suggest that there's more male-on-male assaults than male-on-female because there are many more men in the services. By 2025, we expect that 25% of the services will be female, and now it's about 14%. So the numbers are much smaller. But yet one out of three women who make their way into the Veterans Administration seeking help for one reason or another report having been subjected to some form of military sexual trauma. One of the issues has just been the lack of regularized reporting. So it wasn't last year. I think it was the year before. We put in place a requirement that the services conduct an anonymous survey because we know underreporting has been a huge issue, that because people were had to come forward, it didn't trust the environment in which they were making these reports and felt that they would be subjected to personal and professional reprisals, which is the case.
Thrown out of the service in many cases.
And thrown out of the services. So there was a hesitation to not come forward, and that was particularly true where it was a man who'd been assaulted, but difficult as well for women. So we put in place a requirement for a regular report, which is what led to this recent report, which reported 26,000 incidents of unwanted sexual contact. I wouldn't want to suggest
assault.
That that's 26,000 rapes, it's just it reflects a broad array. And now they're tasked to kind of begin to break this down more. And I have to say, when I first got to Congress, I knew of the tail hook, you know, the sort of very visible
incident. Yeah, I should have
said
that was the Navy when people went through this phalanx on either side of the walls and they were getting whacked in the butt and all that kind of stuff.
So I knew of that, but I had no idea it was as pervasive as it was. And one of the very first hearings I attended as a newly elected member was with all the services talking about the programs they'd put in place to deal with this issue. And it suggested something so pervasive, I was really rather taken aback. And then perhaps a month later, went to a luncheon with Wounded Warriors on Capitol Hill, and there were several women in the room, and I went over to just see in general what their experiences had been and asked them. I said, we just had this hearing around sexual assault in the military. Is it as pervasive a problem as this hearing would suggest? And one of the women was a nurse. She'd been deployed multiple times to Iraq and Afghanistan, had never herself been assaulted. But she said, ma'am, I'm more afraid of my own soldiers than I am of the enemy. So, and to protect herself, she always carried a knife or two sort of put into her waistline so that she was prepared. But it suggested a culture, a threatening culture that way beyond the individual incident. So it's a cultural problem. They've got to deal with it on the specific, but they've also got to really look at who they are as institutions and what kind of changes they need to make.
Let's take some phone calls, okay? 877-301-8970. Congresswoman, see the little screen up there? That's where the phone calls are. You can pick the ones that are in red or blue are the ones that are ready to go. So pick one. Can you see it?
I can't.
Sue, pick one.
Okay, let's see.
I'll pick one. Maureen in the car. You were on with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. Hi, Maureen.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Maureen.
Hi, happy to see Marjorie over there and Jim.
Thank you.
I found you surprisingly one day, so I was happy to see that. But
you're all set now, Maureen.
I'm all set.
That's right.
We need more buses.
Oh, I have a question for Nikki. Is that I'm a small business owner up in your area, Merrimack Valley, and my accountant about 3 years ago saw an article in the paper that you were looking to, and I don't know where it stands, for the release of small business owners like myself, that if we draw money from our pension below the 59-year-old age bracket and we pay that awful 10%, that if we're using it to keep our businesses going, wouldn't that be a great tax? Wouldn't that be a nice break for us? The banks are getting bailed out, and we looked at it like, wouldn't that be a good bailout for small business owners? That if we needed to pull money to help keep our businesses going and our employees employed,
You're right. What happened was I had a small business owner come to me, and this was when we had the tremendous downturn in our economy, and so many businesses were losing their line of credit. The banks were just really freezing up. And so, you know, good standing businesses that had always, you know, been responsible, mm-hmm. repaid their loans, were really at risk. And he came to us and said, here I have sitting in my 401k all this money that I have put aside. And essentially, I'd like to draw down from that. But if I do, I'm subjected to a penalty. Is there a way to give me a period of time to draw down, continue to maintain my business, and then give me a period of time in which I can pay it back? And if I don't pay it back, then I would be subjected to whatever penalties might accrue. And we thought that was a great idea because it's essentially your own money. Mm-hmm. You've set it aside. On the other hand, as a country, we also are trying to encourage people to prepare for their retirement. So we didn't want a situation which people simply drew down and then didn't pay back. And when they finally reached their retirement years, you didn't have the little cushion that they needed to support themselves. So we did introduce a bill that would allow for that to happen. But it is a bill that is still working its way. So it's in committee. We will reintroduce it this year because as much as the economy has recovered and people have better access to loans through their banks, there still is this need. I also introduced a bill called the Hires Act, which talks about communities like Lawrence, Massachusetts, where, yes, we're recovering in generally, but some communities are much harder hit. And it's called the Hires Act. And it would be a competitive grant program that communities could compete for and use that money to put people to work in their communities, fixing sidewalks, cleaning up parks, doing whatever a community needs, put people to work rather than having them depend on unemployment benefits or welfare, and at the same time improve the community. Because, yes, I do think we're coming back, but we haven't done it as quickly in some places as we have in others. But small businesses are the backbone of this country. They're the backbone of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I see it on the retail side, and I certainly see it in the small growth companies that are adding tremendous value to our economy.
Maureen, thank you for the call. Let's take another call here. I'm going to take the calls because
you guys
goofed it up and given the opportunity. Dan from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Wow. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for calling. You're on with the Congresswoman.
Hi, Congresswoman.
Hi, Dan.
How are you doing today? I had a question related to the discussion about soldiers' shoes that you were talking about before and the amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned a company, New Balance, as a potential supplier, one of WGBH's neighbors.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting because although New Balance is an American company, only 25% of their products are actually made in America. And interestingly, specific to New Balance, they have a requirement that's at odds with the FTC's requirement for made in America products. They say only 70% of a product needs to be made in America. To be made in America. So three out of every 10 parts of a shoe New Balance makes could actually be made in China.
Well, how do you know this, Dan? How do you know this?
Because I've written about it quite a lot before.
Okay.
Launched a new ad campaign celebrating, you know, all of their made in America products. And, you know, this is, you know, all up there. They got in a big fight with the FTC in the 90s over just this definition. What is it? The FTC says all or virtually all of a product needs to be made in America. New Balance thinks that's unreasonable, and thus only a minimum 70% needs to.
So your question is?
Oh, that was a long explanation. My question to the Congresswoman is, you know, just two parts. How did we get to this point where this is, you know, the high bar, seemingly? This is, you know, the gold standard. This is what people consider made in America, and that's the best we can do. 25% here, and only 70% of the product actually made in the U.S.
Okay,
and
we got it.
What can be done right now to actually encourage companies to make their products in America?
Dan, thank you very much for the call. What do you think?
It's a good question and a very thoughtful one. Number one, I think New Balance has moved to bring more of the component pieces so that it more technically meets the standard of made in America. And I don't quite know where that percentage now exists, but I know they've recognized that criticism and have made some movements to bring back the more of the component pieces. It's number one. Number two, I mean, I think the Make It in America challenge is a great one. And I think we have to be thoughtful about it. So, for example, I look at my kitchen and I say virtually everything mm-hmm. in here today is made somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And
we're all very guilty with our Apple products.
But you know what? You look at a show like The Shark Tank, I don't know if you ever watched the show on NBC.
We missed out the Shark Tank.
Well, you know, these investors, they have, or these investors decide whether or not they're going to invest in a business that comes before them. And it's a contest, and they're actual real businesses. And they always say, where are you making it? And 9 times out of 10, the contestant says, I want to make it in America. And the investor, the shark says, well, if you take it over to wherever, it's going to be this. We have Americans who want to work in America.
It gets to the issue of, so what do we need to make in America?
Right.
You know, and is it going to be the potholder or the knife or the pot or the things that are more cheaply made elsewhere and more broadly available to all consumers, and we all purchase them and we all live with them, and in some respects they make our lives easier as a result of this? Or is it the more value-added side of things? And I think we have to be realistic and say it is the more value-added side of things. And that's where we really, I think, need to make our investment and encourage companies to stay here. So whether it's the kind of tax credits that encourage companies to go, sophisticated companies, to go offshore, to think more carefully about how we keep those companies here, as opposed to recognizing there are some, I mean, when you go to the dollar store mm-hmm. is an homage to China. There's not a thing in it. We're not going to be making those things. This is not where our future lies.
And the clothing, the same thing is with all the clothing. It's from Vietnam or Thailand or Bangladesh.
Yeah, we've become addicted to cheap clothing. I mean, it's really amazing to me, and as I'm sure it is to you, when I was a kid, you know, things cost a lot of money. I didn't have a lot of clothes because my parents didn't have a lot of money.
Mother sewed most of the clothing we
wore. Or as the caller said, it says made in America, but really the fabric was made someplace else and it was stitched together in America.
So I think we have to be realistic about it. But I do think our focus should be on the value-added side of things, the kind of that's why we need to invest in education.
When you say value-added, you mean what? The value to America?
The value to America and the value-added manufacturing, in which it's a higher order of manufacturing.
Yeah, we might not sell the most, but we have the best.
Yeah.
That is the voice of Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows, who's filling in for the vacationing Jim Bradley. The other voice is, of course, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. We're going to talk with her for a few more minutes. You guys can call in with your questions at 877-301-8970 or email at bpr@wgbh.org. I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio. Boston Public Radio. Jim Bradley is on vacation. I am Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows is sitting in. This is our Ask the segment, as in Ask the Congresswoman. And Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas is here to take your calls at 877-301-8970. But before we get back to the calls, you have also done great work with women in Afghanistan and the concern about what's going to happen when we do leave there. What is it like in July 2013 for the average woman in Afghanistan?
Well, I happen to have been able to make a trip to Afghanistan 5 times as a result of being on the House Armed Services Committee. And the last 3 trips, I've traveled with a congressional delegation of 6 members, all of us women, 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans, which is more or less the rule of the Armed Services Committee, that we have to, these trips have to be bipartisan in nature. And we've gone over Mother's Day with a twofold interest. One is in general, just getting a feel for how things are, and we meet with all our military leaders to get briefed on that. But also to meet with our female soldiers who are over there, because it's a very bittersweet time for them to be away from home. And you hear their stories of leaving. One woman in particular, I remember leaving her 6-month-old child and would not see him for a year.
Oh.
And we know how much happened. It's hard for anybody, but somehow it resonates with me as a woman when it's a mother, because I understand how hard that is. And yet they're remarkably capable and able to do what they need to do. So we go to sort of commiserate with them and say, you know, you're not forgotten. But we also have put a real focus in meeting with Afghan women. And much has changed in their lives, especially with those we've met. So this last time, this last May, we went to Herat. This is a city in western part of Afghanistan, about an hour plus from the Iranian border, a commercial center because it is so close to Iran. And we went to a university, Herat University, where 40% of the students were female. That was not mm-hmm. imaginable in the era of the Taliban. I mean, these children were not allowed anywhere near a school. In a previous trip, we went to a middle school in eastern Afghanistan, where 1,000 young girls cycled through it on a given day. This is a lot of women, young girls, seeking an education, and a lot of families supporting that effort. This past trip, we went to a military academy that's being fashioned after West Point, because the goal of the last few years under President Obama has been to train Afghan national security forces so that they can protect their country themselves as we draw down. And at the academy, there were just a handful of women, but we were able to meet with them, and they're very committed to being part of their military for Afghan military's future. So these are the kinds of changes that medical care is mm-hmm. much improved. So much at risk. The leaders we met with are very concerned that as reconciliation takes place, to the extent the Taliban are at the table, that there will be an effort to trade away bringing the Taliban back into the government in exchange for eliminating the gains for women and girls. So they're insistent, and rightfully so, that women be part of that reconciliation process, that the elections that are coming next year in April 2014 are assured, that women are assured that they are able to fully participate, so their voice is heard as part of that process, and that we as a country continue to raise the issue of how women's rights are secured. And I came back, along with my colleagues across the aisle, across the board, fully committed to doing that.
We're going to go back to the calls, and we are going to jump over to Nancy on line one. And Nancy is calling from Framingham. Nancy, welcome to Ask Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas.
Yes, Nikki, I wish to speak very much intimately, woman to woman. I subscribe to a news magazine, The Week, from June 28, 2013. There was a synopsis of a column in from the Washington Post by Lieutenant Colonel Elizabeth Robbins of the U.S. Army on the subject as drinking and the military's rape epidemic, and that's what it boils down to. Alcohol, it's not being covered. It's being pushed under the table, or women are being pushed under the table, you might say, and men too, probably. And that the trouble is that the drinking culture in the military is continuing. And for the final sentence in the synopsis of this column by Lieutenant Colonel Robbins in the Washington Post is
Nancy, I'm sorry.
The military's honor is at stake.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what's your question to the Congresswoman about this?
The question is, no one is addressing the fact that alcohol abuse in the military is behind the rape epidemic.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Well, the issue of alcohol actually is cited quite frequently as a reason for the sexual assaults that are taking place. So I think think it's an issue that the military, as part of looking at its culture, should address that issue. But I don't think there should be any excuses, because when you enlist in the military, you are making a commitment to a profession. Now, it is a profession that is very holistic in that you live and work with those you're serving with, but you're saying that you want to put your life on, you're prepared mm-hmm. to put your life on the line for your country. And what the military, I believe, needs to do is say this is a professional environment at all times, and whether it's drinking, whether it's any other kind of behavior that's not called for. The way I say it is, if I were in a law firm and there was somebody who was allegedly assaulting women over and over again, do you think that assailant would be allowed to stay in that law firm?
No, but you know what?
And so it's It's raising the bar on the professional nature of military service.
You know, there's been recent studies, though, that have come out that, you know, have alluded to the fact that if we could work on, as a nation and as a people, if we could work on issues of mental health and substance abuse, our crime rates would drop dramatically. And I think, you know, the way that the military, as an expression of ourselves, has dealt with mental illness and has dealt with other abuse issues, you know, it's to the caller's point, this is what we allow to happen. And, you know, if we're not addressing the underlying, you know, I can't imagine that we're just enlisting predators. You know, I don't believe that to be true. So what environment goes through to allow this to happen? You know, and the alcohol and mental illness has got to be a huge part of it.
It is. And I think the mental health issues become very apparent, too, with the rate of suicide.
Right, right.
And, so there are a lot of, you know, the military is in many respects a microcosm mm-hmm. of who we are as
right.
a nation, but it is also a profession.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of creating professional standards and then dealing with all the human issues that people necessarily bring to their work wherever they are.
Congresswoman, we did not get to all the calls and we're out of time. If the callers hold on, can your aide take the information and maybe find
sure.
out?
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
also, do you have a website that people can?
I happen to have a Facebook page.
Oh, wow.
A Facebook page, which you can access through Rep Tsongas.
Okay.
And I have a Twitter feed, Nikki in the House.
So oh, I love that.
That's a great way to find out, you know, access me. And then I do a lot of things called Congress on Your Corner, where I go to my communities, the communities that I represent, and let the community know I'm coming so people can come and talk to me. We do an e-newsletter that you can sign up for on my website. And then we also do a lot of teletown halls. We're able to mm-hmm. use technology to reach out into a community and let people stay online for about an hour and talk about, as we are here,
that's
talk
terrific.
About whatever issue people have, you know, want to hear my thoughts on.
And didn't I see something about something going on tomorrow online?
Every Thursday.
Including the 4th of July?
Yes, we're going to call it.
Stuffing yourself with potato salad and cornbread.
Well, you
and
can
hot
do
pulse.
Both at the same time. We're going to call it Third District's Thursdays, and we're just going to solicit stories about people, places, things you're doing, and just kind of give a feel for mm-hmm. all the things that are taking place across the 3rd District, which goes now from Haverhill to Gardner mm-hmm. and then swings down to Marlborough, Concord, Acton, no longer most of Sudbury, but Stowe, Harvard. Anyway, it's a great district.
Well, thanks for your work on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the DOMA. You know,
that's right.
Congressman, because I watch Star Trek
okay.
a lot and
she
everyone is male on Star
can't
Trek.
You?
But thanks so much for your work on behalf of the gay community, which is
well,
a
great
strong advocate.
Coming out of the Supreme Court.
Yeah. I think yeah. that Smith women do wonderful work in terms of
they
women's
do, don't
rights.
They?
And Congresswoman has been proud, made her alma mater, Smith College, very proud. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas from the 3rd Congressional District, thank you so much for
thank
being
you,
with
thank
us
you,
today.
Sue.
We much appreciate it.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you, too. We're going to talk about that,
yes,
actually.
Yes, we are.
Up next, whether or not you're planning to head down to the Esplanade for the 4th of July fireworks, or you're a little nervous this year, or you don't want all that security, and you want to bring your cooler on wheels, and they won't let you. Are you going or not to the 4th of July celebration? That conversation comes up next, 89.7 WGBH. Okay, we wanted to get you in the mood here. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy's off. I'm Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows is fitting in. She's
I'm
not fitting in.
Too.
She's
fitting in, okay.
sitting in for the vacationing Browdy. He'll be back on Monday. That, of course, is the 1812 Overture.
I'm all set
which
now.
You will hear as the fireworks go off and everybody's all excited and they're cheering and yelling and cannons and all that. Well, Are you going to go to the fireworks this year? That's what you want to know at 877-301-8970. Some people are not going. They're a little bit freaked out about the marathon. It was only a couple of months ago, back in April, when we had this terrible, tragic situation at the marathon. We know now that security is much, much tighter at the Esplanade. There's going to be no coolers on wheels, no backpacks, no glass containers.
That means no lesbians can go if there's no backpacks or coolers on wheels. That's it. The whole lesbian nation is staying home.
I did not know there was a lesbian
if you're in Provincetown at the beach, you know, and the boys go down to the point and the women are at Herring Cove and they're pulling, you know, they bring hibachis and, you know, it's the whole thing. It's a major camp down. So
I did not realize that.
Yes. That's why I'm here as a cultural liaison.
There'll be no lesbians on the Esplanade according to Sue O'Connell.
If you can't bring your cooler on wheels.
And you also have to have your personal items carried in clear plastic bags, you know, like you do on the airplanes.
I don't want anyone looking at my personal items.
Well, that's the other thing. You're going to have a pretty big clear plastic bag carrying all your personal items, or you're going to have 27 baggies or quart.
I wish I had bought stock in the Ziploc bag people, the clear bag people, because it can't go anywhere without a Ziploc bag.
There are obviously big-time security issues this year, and it's going to be a lot more difficult to get in. They only have two entrances and exits, and you're going to have to go through metal detectors, and they may be looking at your bags. The security is going to be less obvious on the Cambridge side, but there will be twice as many police officers there, some of them in uniform, some of them in plain clothes. So are you going to go this year? If you always have gone, there was a story about a couple yesterday in the Globe talking about how their family has gone for years. This year, the father's going to go, and the mom says, I think not this year. I think the children and I are going to go someplace else and watch them. Or maybe you never went. I mean, I've only gone once in my whole life, and it was such a mob scene, I couldn't take it.
You know, I think it's also the bigger conversation about where we are in the world right now, where we are in this time. You know, we spoke before air that I went with my daughter and my niece to the free concert that happened at City Hall Plaza on Sunday. A pop radio station had Selena Gomez and a couple of other pop sensations. And it was very crowded. It was very hot. You know, free concerts, which happen all the time. A lot of radio stations sponsor them at City Hall Plaza. And a bunch of knuckleheads got into a fight, an old-fashioned fight behind us. And there were a lot of parents in the crowd, which usually there aren't. You know, these are teens and tweens, and the teens are misbehaving in their own little ways. But I noticed there were lots of parents there, and I was there as well for the reason of being concerned about if something happened.
Yeah.
I wasn't concerned about a bunch of knuckleheads getting in a fist fight. And as soon as it happened, you could see the kids, the younger kids especially, and the look of fear in their eyes. You know, older kids were going, hey, there's a fight. Let's look. Let's, you know, put it on YouTube. But some kids actually ran off because they were afraid. And the other grown-ups and myself in the crowd started yelling, it's just a fight. You know, like this.
You mean
they
were afraid of like terrorism or shooting or bombs?
Yes, you know, and it was, you know, as someone who grew up in Revere and has been to my number of concerts, you can tell the difference in fear of someone's eyes. Like, oh, am I going to get pushed? Or, oh my gosh, is something really bad happening? And it really, you know, it really hit it home for me that we're in a new spot. I mean, I was raised by parents who lost relatives in the Coconut Grove fire and who lost...
I did not know that.
Yeah,
Coconut Grove was in 1948,
yeah,
I believe.
Way back,
how many,
you know,
400, 500 people were killed,
you know,
in a nightclub, for people that don't know, when they locked the doors
right,
and people could not get out.
Big, big fire, terrible thing. So every time I went in someplace, my parents were always telling me where the fire exit was. And I do it now with my daughter, Ruby. We go to a movie theater. Here's where you go out. Don't wait for me. And as we were going to City Hall Plaza, I said to my nieces and my daughter, if something happens, go that way. Don't wait for us, you know. And I realized that now I'm like really meaning it. You know, I used to just say it as part of how I was brought up. But, you know, so I think that anxiety is there now and we have to get used to it. Like, I'm not going to stop going places that I always go to. I've never gone to the 4th on the Esplanade. I've seen the fireworks. But if I were going, I wouldn't let it stop me.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Are you going to the Esplanade this year? If you have gone in previous years, are you sitting it out because you're concerned frankly, about your safety on the Esplanade this year? Or is it because you don't want the hassle of all this extra security? Mayor Menino says that they're not going to shut down Boston while I'm mayor. He said that statement, and he's talked about all the extra security that's going to be there. Last night I was on Greater Boston filling in for Emily Rooney, and we had the Colonel Albin from the State Police, and we had the commissioner from the from the Department of Recreation. And I asked them, I'm going to hear that sound in a second, about their plans for the 4th of July. Let's hear that sound.
I've been there for about the last 10 years, but this will be the first year that my family is actually going to come and enjoy the fireworks.
Really? Now, why are you bringing them this year?
Well, we had planned to do it, you know, before anything occurred out of the ordinary, and it was just an opportunity, you know, to bring everybody together and come down here and enjoy the festivities.
So that makes me feel good that a state police colonel is having his family there. How about you, Commissioner?
Yeah, no, my wife and my niece and nephews have enjoyed the festivities in the past and plan to again this year.
Okay, so we had the Colonel Timothy Albin from the State Police and the Commissioner of the Department of Recreation, Jack Murray, both saying their families are going to be on the Esplanade this year. That made me feel good that they were bringing their families with them.
This is like Israel for us now. This is how we unfortunately have to live, and we need to be used to high scrutiny security to keep us safe. It doesn't mean that it's definitely going to keep us safe. It doesn't mean that we're definitely in danger. But, you know, the first time that I really felt the loss of something around security was obviously post 9/11. I took my daughter to the Statue of Liberty maybe 3 years ago, and being searched before you get on the ferry, you know, when I'm standing with people from around the world, you know, it just happened that I was surrounded by tourists, and you know, having to do this to go see the Statue of Liberty really insulted me, but I wasn't upset about the security.
What do you mean, sir? They're patting you down?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but we definitely had to take our bag out and have it searched. And I wasn't upset that we had security. I was upset for the reason we needed security, that this is what has been taken from us. And this is what has been taken from us. This is where we are, that if we want to gather as we do and celebrate on a day like the 4th of July, which is one of my favorite holidays. I'm a big schmush when it comes to patriotic stuff. You know, this is what we'll have to go through, and we have to get used to it.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in on the Esplanade, whether you're going or not, and safety issues. And the other thing is, I've only gone to the Esplanade once. Usually, I go down the Cape, and it's great because you have little fireworks.
I usually sit on the couch.
Yeah, well, you can sit on the couch and watch
on TV. I watch it on the TV.
And by the way, I think this year, even though the Boston Pops lost their nationwide contract that had them bringing
in Dr. Phil. I blame Dr.
Phil.
Dr.
Phil was a guest at the Esplanade. That was crazy.
He was the host.
And no matter how much you like Jennifer Hudson or Toby Keith, who also came and sang, they're not from Boston.
No.
I mean, this year, Ayla Brown, we're going to hear Ayla Brown in just a couple of minutes. Ayla Brown is going to be seen. There's local people. There's some rapper from Roxbury who's going to be seen.
We don't need a TV show. We didn't need a national TV show.
Yeah, well, we did lose it. Keith Lockhart admitted that he was a little bit upset about it, but he's dealing with it because he can have most of the local.
I have a secret crush on him.
On Keith Lockhart?
Yeah, I do.
He is adorable. He's very dynamic.
I find him fascinating.
Well, you got to be a brilliant guy to do what he does. Mm-hmm. And the Boston Pops, if you have never taken.
Yeah.
I've gone at Christmas. Shouldn't be talking about this on July 4th, but the Christmas Pops, one of the great things. It's worth every cent you pay for your kids. But I go down to the Cape, and this year I'm very upset because I have a dog. And last year, I thought he was going to die.
You have a dog? I hadn't heard about your dog.
Yeah, my dog. I thought I was Harry the P, best dog from C to C. And he was so beside himself last year. I went out and got the thunder coat, you know, the fireworks coat. Pays $50. You wrap
How'd
it around.
How'd that work out for you, Marjorie?
Didn't work at all. It was a wasted $50. So this year, when the fireworks began, I'm getting in the car and driving off somewhere so he's not close to
another community with fireworks, probably.
Well, we'll have to go someplace with a tank of gas and pollute the air by running the air conditioner in the car. But I'm not going to subject him. It was like a torture
Listen,
thing.
He's a dog.
I
okay,
know.
The
he was
dogs,
an extremist.
I know. I think, first of all, that the reason we are friends with canines is because they came into our caves when it got thundery.
Yeah.
You know, that they're animals out in the woods all the time, Marjorie, that have thunder. And they don't need to crawl up on your head like our dogs do. I mean, I love my dog, Anna.
Yes.
But, you know, she's going to be a shivering mess. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can hug them, which is a cheaper way, Marjorie, than buying a $50 thunder coat. You know, I mean, even Ted the teddy bear was afraid of thunder, and he wasn't even a real thing from Ted the movie.
Well, fireworks are torture for dogs. Our number is 877-301-8970. Whoops, got that wrong, Marjorie. 877-301-8970, bprwgbh.org. We're talking all things July 4th, Esplanade or not. And if anybody's got any tips on the dog, I'll take those.
Let's take a call here.
Yes, let's go to Erica in Belrica.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
You were talking a couple of times about the difficulty of finding clear plastic bags.
Yeah, where do I go? Home Depot?
No, well, probably, but Ziploc makes great big ones. They're clear. They're a little bit blue-tinted, but they are clear. And I'm not sure what they call them, storage bags, I think. They come in several different sizes. I have some that are like 2 feet long by almost 2 feet across.
Oh. But do you want people looking at your stuff?
Very heavy plastic, and they have a built-in handle, and they zip as well. I mean, you can, like, store blankets in them.
Really? I could just see you walking to the Esplanade carrying your clear bag.
Are you going, Erica, with your Ziploc bags?
No.
Do you ever go?
No. I would have to be able to bring along my own personal porta-potty with me.
Well, that's what the Ziploc bag is for, you empty it out.
Oh, that's true. No line for me. I suppose I could strap the Ziploc bag.
There you go.
Okay, so one last question, Erica. Do you get the Ziploc bags like at Stop and Shop or Shaw's?
I've bought them in supermarkets and also in hardware stores. They come in like three or five to a package, but they're really heavy, thick plastic. Like, you can put a fair amount of weight in there.
I know we're off topic, Marjorie,
Erica.
But, you know, I am a huge fan of the Ziploc bag when traveling, especially if you've got you're traveling with an infant.
Yeah.
Because you can put the dirty diaper in the Ziploc bag and the smell doesn't get out.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, when I traveled, internationally with my baby.
Uh-huh.
Ziploc bags made it all worthwhile.
I did not know that.
Yeah, lots of good
too
uses.
Late for me.
Oh,
thank
well,
God.
You never know.
The children are off at college and they're house trained. They are very well trained. Okay, thank you for the call, Erica. Let's go to Michaela in Boston. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
What do you think about the 4th of July?
I think so. I work in Copley Square, and I have for the past couple of years, and I was there the day of the marathon bombing.
Oh.
And I can't say for certain that I would be going anyway, but I know for a fact I would not go this year because of the anxiety I felt kind of since then.
And, Michaela,
and I kind of feel guilty about it.
Well, Michaela, that's an interesting, you've kind of hit the nail on the head here, two issues. You feel almost like you don't want it to be taken away from you, and you don't want things to change your behavior. At the same time, you're going to take care of yourself. I mean, I'm sorry you were there and that happened to you. Do you feel like your regular public behavior has changed?
To a degree, and I don't know how long it's going to last for, but things that are usually big, exciting, fun events, I'm kind of wary of. And, you know, you mentioned that concert and the fear you saw in the kids' eyes. Well, I was at a Red Sox game a couple weeks ago, and, you know, there was a couple of people just running, and they were just, like, moving around. They were running somewhere else, but my, like, heart stopped.
Yeah.
No, it's from the running, because it just brought me back.
I'm sorry. Yeah, are you seeing anyone? You getting some help? You talking about it, other than to me and Marjorie?
I talk about it. I mean, I'm not really losing sleep or anything like that, but it's just, you know, there's something in the back of my mind that hadn't been there before, and I just kind of want to get out of the city for the day.
Yeah. Well, don't wait to get help if you need it. I mean, Marjorie and I are happy to talk to you every week about it, but we don't have a degree or anything, you know. And
Michaela,
goodness knows what we'll tell you to do.
Michaela, thank you very much for the call, and I hope you feel better. It is awful. I mean, I think that was one of the things about the marathon in Boston, even for people unlike Michaela who weren't on the scene. It's such a tradition for us. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember going down there as a reporter the day of the marathon. Of course, you couldn't get to the finish line, but you could interview the people that were walking away from the finish line, and they were telling you what they'd seen, which was very upsetting. Mm-hmm. And I think many, many weeks later, some of those people are still. Do you see where the guy, if people don't know this, there was a terrible story today in both the Herald and the Globe about the guy that defrauded the one
South
fund.
Ender. Well, you know, it's
said
funny.
He said his aunt had lost both her legs. In fact, his aunt has been dead for 10 years.
The guy certainly isn't playing with a full deck here. I mean, if you're going to defraud, you don't use your dead aunt of 10 years. I think it was unfortunate.
And they nabbed him with the $2.19 million fake check, and he was subsequently arrested.
You know, I think it's important, too, when we talk about the environment that we're in. It's not just terrorism. It's also incidents that happen across America that for right or wrong, or, you know, from an impartial standpoint, get a lot of play. I mean, people are still wary about going to movie theaters since the Colorado movie.
Well, don't you think about it? Every time you go in,
an incident when I went with my daughter. We went during that month. And we went to see Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the summer edition, and a little kid got locked out of the theater in the front and started banging on the door because I don't know what he was doing or where his parents were. And the whole theater erupted, afraid that something had happened, of course. And me, like an idiot, I go up to go get him and let him in, and my daughter will never forgive me that I left her in this moment of trauma. But this is what the kids, this is what kids under 25 are thinking now. This is their reality that, these things happened in some regard when we were young, but we didn't have CNN. We didn't have the news.
God.
We didn't have the web.
I was thinking about the Russians.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were hiding under our desk.
Yeah, that was a whole different thing because the Russians did not want to die like we didn't want to die.
Right.
So it was a different
sort of enemy.
Heather from Framingham, are you celebrating the 4th of July? Are you not? What are your thoughts?
I will not be celebrating it in Boston only because I'm actually driving on my way to Gloucester.
Oh, good.
Otherwise, I would go, but I wanted to say this girl who called in, who was at Clarendon, who works on Copley Square, she should not feel guilty. She has every right to feel the way she feels. I was there. My children had just crossed the finish line. They ran the marathon. The anxiety I felt, not knowing where they were at that moment, will never leave me.
Yep.
She should not feel guilty. I hope she's got someone who loves her, she can talk and walk.
You know, we've got a lousy
Heather,
connection.
Thank you
Heather.
For the call. It's a bad cell connection, but I believe Heather said that she was there.
Michaela
and her children
should not feel guilty.
Her children had just come over the finish line, or they ran the race. I hope I didn't get that incorrectly.
No. But
Heather,
that's part of the American, that's part of who we are as Americans, and a lot of people are. You know, we don't want to not be there because, we're upset. We know statistically that nothing bad's going to happen. Statistically, the worst thing that's going to happen is you won't be able to find a pot. You won't be able to find a place to go to the bathroom.
You know, I should point out, because I did have a chance last night, as I said before, on the Greater Boston, to interview both the head of the state police and the head of the commissioner of the Department of Recreation or whatever it is. He's the guy that he supervises all this.
He's the boss.
He's the boss. And after talking to them, I felt much better because they have made it so there's only certain places you can come in to the oval in front of the Hat Shell and the place behind the Hat Shell and Lagoon, so-called. There's only certain places you can come in. There's only certain places you can go out. There's going to be twice as many police officers there as usual. On the Cambridge side, same thing. There's not going to be the egress access deal, but there are going to be many more plainclothes policemen. They're going to be able to look at backpacks, look inside the backpacks, all this kind of stuff. So I think in reality, it's going to be much safer this year than it's ever been before. But if you've gone through the traumas, Michaela, that called,
or
Heather, why would you want to be in a big crowd
only
a couple of months later in Boston? You just don't want to do it. And it's interesting. We're going to hear, we're going to talk to Ayla Brown in a second. And there have been she's performing with the Boston Pops. One of the performers did admit she was a little bit nervous. Mm-hmm. But as Keith Lockhart has said, it is going to be patrolled like never before.
Listen,
not going to be an armed camp, but it's going to be very carefully patrolled. So that should reassure people.
The best advice, and again, I go to my mom and dad, just have an exit plan, have a strategy, get used to talking to your kids about it. No, don't make it like every time it's a crowd. Let them know if you're at a movie theater, you leave, don't worry about me, here's where we'll meet. And it doesn't have to be a big, terrible thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up this way and I go out all the time. I'm not stuck in my house. You know?
Oh, that's good, Sue O'Connell.
I'm okay.
I'm glad you can venture outside.
I will be on the couch, though. I will be on the couch.
Okay. Coming up, we're going to talk to Ayla Brown. She's, of course, the daughter of former Senator Scott Brown. She's also she almost got to the top 10 in American Idol.
Great.
She's got a great voice. She's performing in this year's 4th of July celebration in Boston. Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan, and we are here in the studio with Ayla Brown. Many of you may have seen her when she was back in 2005 on American Idol. I watched every episode with my kids. And you may have seen her at Boston College playing basketball, where she was a standout as a shooter. And you may know that she's going to sing the Star Spangled Banner at the Esplanade on the 4th of July. Thank you for being with us, Ayla Brown.
Thank you. I actually want to make a correction. I'm not doing the Star Spangled Banner, but I am performing with the Boston Pops.
You are performing with the Boston Pops.
And I'm performing two songs with the Pops. One of them is my single called Pride of America. And then another one is a song written by Brett James and Hillary Lindsay down in Nashville, specifically for the Boston Pops, called Free. No one has ever heard this song before, and this will be like one of its first debuts.
That's very exciting.
So I'm talk about pressure.
Yeah, there is. Well, tell us, you brought me your new CD.
I did.
Tell us about the new CD.
Absolutely. It's called Heroes and Hometowns,
yep.
And it's a patriotic-inspired CD where part of every CD sale benefits a military nonprofit out of Massachusetts called Hugs for Heroes.
Yeah.
And it's sponsored by New Balance, and pretty much contains all patriotic or songs that make you feel like you want to go back home. And so I wrote it in mind for all the soldiers and military members out there who are kind of missing their families.
Ayla Brown, Heroes and Hometowns, where can people get it?
They can get it on one of the singles, Pride of America, on iTunes right now. It's only 99 cents. Or they can go to aylabrown.com, and I actually sign and personalize and send myself every copy.
That's fantastic.
I know. It kind of gives me something to do, and I really enjoy it. So
can we hear a couple of bars of Pride of America that you're going to be singing?
Sure.
Okay.
I guess I should do... I'll do the chorus. Is that good?
Yes. Now let me say that we went back and forth on the guitar. No guitar. The guitar is not here. So so you might feel more comfortable with the guitar. But Ayla Brown is going to do an a cappella, few notes from the song she's going to be singing on the Esplanade July 4th.
All right. Here it is. This is called Pride of America. Yeah, it's in our hearts, it's in our homes, up city streets and down country roads. Why we dream a little bigger and walk a little taller in our shoes. No, we can't help it and we can't hide it. We're born and raised, stand behind it. When a hand over heart, flag in the yard attitude shines through, that's the pride of America.
That was fantastic. You didn't need the guitar. That was absolutely fantastic. So, Ayla Brown, tell me, how does it happen? How do you wind up performing on the Esplanade 4th of July? Do you have to get selected, or how does it work?
I got an email, and they said, what are you doing July 4th? And I said, oh my gosh, I really think this is about to happen. I think they want me to sing on the Esplanade. And I said, oh, nothing really planned right now. I'm waiting for something pretty big to happen. And so Dennis was the one who sent me the email from the Pops, and I've worked with him many times in the past. He was the one that got me to sing when I was 17, right off of American Idol, my first performance with the Boston Pops on the Esplanade in 2006. And since then, I've done a few anthems with the Pops, traveling with them. And then I got to do the Boston Pops on the Heights.
That's at Boston College.
And I got to do one of my own songs from my first album that I ever released when I was 17. So I have a really great relationship with the Pops. So when he asked me if I was available July 3rd and 4th to do Not only one song, but technically three. I'm going to be doing three on the night of July 3rd and 4th. One of them is Pride of America with the orchestra. The second is Free, which is a song that no one has heard yet. And the third will be before the Pops even come out on the stage. I'm going to be doing it acoustically. It's called Hero in Her Hometown, and it's a song all about our female military members.
Oh, good.
And it's on that CD that you have right there, so well, I hope you like it.
Well, before we're through, I hope you can give us a few bars of Hero in Our Hometown. Hero in Her Hometown. Hero in Her Hometown.
It's all about the women. It's their own special anthem, and I got to sing this and debut it at the Grand Ole Opry on Memorial Day weekend, and I did something on the Opry stage that no one has ever done before. I had 17 female soldiers from Fort Campbell join me up on stage and be recognized, and the place immediately stood up out of their seats and clapped along the rest of the song. It was so moving. It's something that I will never, ever forget.
This, we're talking with Ayla Brown, who's going to be performing at the 4th of July performance of the Boston Pops on the Esplanade, not the Star Spangled Banner, I won't say that, and goof it up, from the Pride of America. But let me ask you something. You've grown up in Massachusetts your whole life.
I have.
You went to Boston College. Mm-hmm. You've gone down to Nashville to pursue your career down there. Is it? I went there over Christmas, actually. Never been
you
there
did.
Before in my life. Yes.
Wasn't it awesome?
Yes, it is awesome. And you walk down these main drags, and every place you go by, somebody's performing live
I know.
In a bar. It's mm-hmm. incredible. But it's very different culturally. How has it been an adjustment for you? Has it been okay or has it been weird?
You know, the first couple months I moved down there, actually, I should tell you a funny story. The second week I was in Nashville, they had what they would consider a snowstorm, which was an inch of snow. And I remember writing in a writing room with two other writers at the time, and they both said, "We got to go. It's starting to flurry." And I'm like, "Come on. I'm from Massachusetts. This is nothing." But I said, "Okay, if you guys feel more comfortable, you know, we can do this right another time." And so we all left. And it was a mass exodus out of the city. Everyone was leaving at around 2 o'clock p.m.
You're
because
kidding.
They wanted to get out of the snow and get home to their families. And it was that day that I was driving home that someone ran into the side of my car. They didn't even know how to drive in the snow. It was that crazy. So it made me think. The second week I was there, I said, okay, there are some cultural differences here.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
Yes.
But what are you doing down there career-wise? What are you doing in Nashville? Tell people.
Well, I write a lot of songs. Nashville is the most inspiring place you'll ever go to because everyone, almost everyone there, is either a songwriter, a performer, a producer, an engineer. You name it, someone is in the music business.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's really inspiring because it makes me want to work that much harder. And so what I do is I'll go and book appointments with writers, and it's kind of like booking an appointment with the doctor. You know, you email them, you say, "Hey, I was wondering if you could write next week," let's just say. And they say, "Well, I'm only free 2.5 months from now. What is your schedule looking like in September?" And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like waiting for the doctor.
You're kidding.
No, because these are people who do this for a living. So you kind of have to wait until the right time, find it. Wait, get in with them, write a great song. And so what I do is after the songs are done, sometimes I demo them, in which, you know, we'll do either a fully produced thing or a guitar vocal track. And when I get enough songs that I truly love, I make a CD. And that's what I did with my first self-titled album. It's called Ayla Brown. And went into the studio down in Nashville and produced the whole thing myself and paid for it all. I don't have to pay anyone back. It was kind of like my... It was kind of like my own baby, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then when I came up with the Heroes and Hometowns concept, the Patriotic CD, I said, okay, it was a little expensive the first time. This is such a really good project. I want to see if New Balance wants to get involved. And so I cold called them and I said...
You cold called them yourself.
I
good
called
for you.
Them myself and I said, I've recognize what you guys have done for the troops in the past, and I wanted to know if you wanted to help sponsor this CD that I'm doing, where part of the proceeds benefit a nonprofit called Hugs for Heroes, and it was started by a friend of mine in high school, and now it's this huge nonprofit that sent over 10 tons of goods overseas to our troops. So they're doing a great job. People should check them out. And so a huge thanks to New Balance for kind of believing in the project. And here it is. You have it in front of you. And it's given me so many opportunities, debuting at the Grand Ole Opry, performing live on the plaza on Fox and Friends on Memorial Day, which made that single Pride of America jump up to number 107 on the iTunes country charts.
Fantastic.
So
good for you.
Things have really been happening. Next week, I'm opening up for Eric Church. And opening up for Josh Turner a few times and Sarah Evans and some of these people that a few years ago I could have only dreamt of doing.
Well, you know, a few years ago, many of us, including myself, were sitting on the couch watching American Idol with my kids every week. And you got really high up. I think you were up to like number 15 or 16.
Yes, I was. I was literally lucky number 13 is what I like to say, because I was the last person standing as they were choosing and filling the top 12 seats. So
yeah,
I was there
really
just like looking at those seats thinking, oh, come on. I couldn't have gotten one more spot. But
how nerve-wracking was that? Because how old were you then, Ayla?
Well,
when you did that?
I was 17.
17, which is
very
young.
I had never sung in front of a soul. I mean, gosh. I sang for the first time with a band on American Idol, and I knew at that moment when I was on the stage with the band, hearing background singers singing behind me, that I needed to be on stage. And so I'm kind of thankful in a way that my college career is over so I can pursue this full time. And I'm so blessed. I haven't had to pick up a 9-to-5 job yet, and I'm singing for a living.
Good for you. I have a question about American Idol I've always wondered about.
Okay.
Because I was watching it all the time, and I enjoyed it with my children. I always wondered about these people that would get up there and they could not sing any more than I can sing. They were awful and they were painful. And I always wondered, do they really think they can sing? Or are they just sort of, it's their 5 minutes to get on TV, and if they're really horrible, like that poor William Hung guy, it's just like 15 minutes of fame. Did you have any sense of what was really going on?
Oh, I had a lot of sense. Whether or not I should share it is the question. But basically what they do is, before you even see the judges, you go through 3 rounds of auditions.
Mm-hmm.
So before you see, at my time, it was Simon, Randy and Paula.
Yep. Simon, very charming guy.
Oh, yeah. He's so nice. Loved him.
Yeah.
But what they do is, you know, the producers of the show, they kind of put through bad people and then they put through good people. And what they do is the round right before the judges' rounds, the executive producers of the show will hear these bad people. And instead of saying that they're bad, what they'll do is say, that was fantastic. But when you go see the judges, because we're going to give you another chance, why don't you be a little bit more theatrical with your movements? Pretend like you're performing in front of a million people when you're in front of the judges. So really big hand movements and sing your heart out. You're fantastic.
Oh.
So they'll go in and the judges, and the
That's
judges will then, you know, like Simon will be brutally honest and say, you're horrible. And these people will say, but people tell me I'm good.
Oh,
I know.
God.
It's so sad.
Oh,
it's
God.
So sad. And I only know this is because I was there behind the scenes and not many people know stuff like that. But on the flip side, it's what makes great TV.
It does make great TV.
You know,
it does make great TV. You're sitting there watching this thinking, can this person really think that they're good? And apparently,
and they've been brainwashed through the first 3 rounds
they do.
Thinking that, you know, they're really, really great. But, you know, that's what makes it a good TV show, a family show where you can literally sit there with your family and laugh and cry and connect with the artists and feel like you're really part of the American dream, because that's what it is. It's finding someone who's been nothing, who's had nothing, and trying to make them a superstar in front of your eyes in the span of a few months. So
who won the whole thing the year you did it?
Taylor Hicks won my year.
Oh, Taylor Hicks. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But we had Daughtry and Catherine McPhee and Kelly Pickler. I mean, we had some great people.
That have gone on to have pretty good careers too, right?
Yeah.
We're talking with Ayla Brown, who is going to be performing on the Esplanade July 4th. If you don't know, her mom and dad, Gail Huff, who actually works at WGBH, Scott Brown, our former United States Senator. When did they say to you, I mean, a lot of little girls think they can sing. When did your parents realize, you know, that this kid has some vocal cords here, maybe we should get her some lessons or whatever? When did they realize?
Well, it's weird. My mom always tells a story that when I was in kindergarten or first grade, they got a phone call from the teacher telling them that they needed to come to school immediately. And so my mom, you know, packed up the car and rushed to the school, and the teacher looked at her and said, you know, we've tried many different tactics, but Ayla just won't stop singing. I'll be in the middle of teaching the kids how to color or draw or ABCs or whatever, and she just, it's like I'm not even there. She won't stop singing. And so instead of my mom taking it seriously, she just laughed and she's like, welcome to my world, you know? And so I think that was the one of the beginning signs that I just love to sing. But when I realized that I was a little bit better than, I guess, the average kid was when I would listen to Disney movies and sing along, I noticed in my mind that I sounded like the princesses that were singing. And I would try and make my voice sound exactly like them.
Oh, yeah?
And when I was on key, I think that's when I realized that I had some sort of singing ability. But I don't know. My mom and dad were encouraging no matter what. They told me I was good, and they still do, whether or not I am or not. So
I think you don't have to worry about that anymore. You've had yourself a great career. On the way out, can you sing us one more song from your CD?
Sure.
Ayla Brown, Heroes and Hometowns.
Yeah, I'll do the other one that I'm going to be singing on July 3rd and 4th. It's called Hero in Her Hometown. And if there are any female military members, this song is truly written for you and no one else. This is dedicated to you, and you can get the copy of the CD at any of my shows throughout the summer and throughout the year, and also on aylabrown.com. But here's the chorus of that one. She's a hero in her hometown. When she walks in a room, she draws a crowd. Celebrated, decorated with medals and pins from the war she was in. Served just like her father did. And two generations before him made the choice and served her country proud. She's a hero in her hometown.
That was wonderful. That is the voice of Ayla Brown. You can see her on television 4th of July night performing at the Esplanade, or you can get down there and see her in person. Ayla Brown, thank you very much, and best of luck,
Marjorie,
in your career down in Nashville.
Thanks.
Thank you. Oh, okay, coming up, we have got a great summer concert roundtable. WGBH's Edgar B. Herwick III and WCRB's Brian McCreath join forces with Berklee College's Rob Hochschild to talk about the best live music in New England for July and August. More in a minute here on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Welcome, all you guys. We're going to have a summer music extravaganza. We've got a little jazz, a little rock, and a little classical. And we're joined in studio. Sue O'Connell is here filling in for Jim Browdy. We're also joined by Edgar B. Herwick III from WGBH, Curiosity Desk, Rob Hochschild.
Got correct.
Right that time. Berklee College of Music, and Brian McCreath from WCRB, who's going to do the classical New England, but he's going to do the classical music thing, of course. And you can catch all our panel's concert picks. I should point out, so you don't get frantic if you're driving in the car trying to write this all down. Everything you hear in the next few minutes is going to be on our website at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Okay, who's going to start this extravaganza?
Well, let's kick it over to Rob, I think, who's the newbie here. He's never done one of these before, so let's put him on the hot seat straight out of the gate, right? I think that makes the most sense.
You have to stand on your head.
I can do that.
That's what we do here.
Well, so what's the deal, Rob? What's the deal? What are you going to tell us about and play for us?
Well, my first choice here today to talk about is the Newport Jazz Festival. Kind of an obvious choice, but there's so many great artists this year. There's a long list of performers. Everybody's heard of Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Esperanza Spalding. But here's a name that you've never heard. Ali Amer, and his band is the Ali Amer Experiment. And he is a Palestinian canoon and canoon player and vocalist.
What is a canoon?
Yeah, let's go with canoon. Is a harp. It's a lap harp with 27 sets of strings.
Wait, 27 sets?
Yeah. Yeah, they're called courses. Each set of three rings one note, and this fellow plays a 72-string instrument.
I was told there'd be no math.
It's all about the resonance. Just don't. Okay. Yeah,
that's right.
There's some strings that hang out and don't do anything except vibrate.
Okay.
Right.
It's a beautiful sound. It's a great instrument. And this kid was a virtuoso when he came to Berkeley. And he came to Berkeley because he wanted to study jazz and study other forms of music and then fuse everything with the music of his homeland. So we're going to listen to part of a tune called Najat 1958, which he wrote and recorded recently at Berkeley. And he's playing on the main stage at Newport on Saturday, August 3rd.
Terrific. Sounds wonderful. How old is this guy?
He's about 22 years old now.
So he's a kid.
He is really pretty much a kid, but he's so driven and has been focused on music since he was 7 years old. And you can hear right there was like a Latin percussion mm-hmm. thing
yeah,
happening.
Yeah, definitely.
One of those players is from Spain, and another one is also from the Palestinian territories, and that's part of the fusion that he's doing. So a little
What do you teach, Rob, at Berkeley?
I'm actually on staff. I'm in the communications office.
Oh, you are?
I have taught writing at Berkeley, but mostly.
So you are. Are you a fraudulent member of the staff here? Do you have a musical instrument that you play at least?
Strong language.
I'm supposed to be able to play. I hope you can play at least Do Re Mi and the piano there, Rob.
I prefer the term hacker or abuser of musical instruments. I play guitar and saxophone.
The man communicates about music. That's the point.
What's the stance on the Newport Jazz Festival this year? I know every year and every decade it's sort of got a new direction, or you know, how would you sum it up this year? What's Newport about this year?
That is an excellent question.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't know that I can really boil it down to mm-hmm. one particular idea, but it's loaded with the old and the young, and this Wayne Shorter Quartet is really one of the big performers on the whole bill, and they've got, it's like an all-star band, and I think everything's kind of focused around that and kicks off there. So it's a lot of the old and a lot of the new, and I think that this things like Ali Amer playing on the main stage is a new thing for them, a little bit of the international as well.
Since Dylan brought that electric guitar, things
Hey, Rob, so we listened to Ali Amer, and I'm just curious, you know, this is a flavor of music that a lot of us haven't really heard. It's infused with jazz. So how much of that is improvisation, and how much of that is kind of written out composition?
Another good question.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of improvisation on this tune. I mean, I think that there's some established sort of modal areas, and there's the arrangement is more sort of macro in a way. So there's not a chord progression. There's not a harmony that everybody's carefully following. And the interesting thing is I think there's an improvisational approach that's both sort of based in the Middle East and based in American jazz music and Latin jazz music, and they kind of come together. So to answer your question, I think it's very much an open composition with a lot of improvisation.
So the sound world is there, but when you show up at Newport, it's going to be something that hasn't even happened before anywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
this will be never heard before.
Actually. Okay, we'll go around the table. We'll go from Bob to Brian, then to Edgar, okay? So Brian McCreath I got that right, didn't I?
Well done.
From WCIB Classical New England, what do you got?
Oh, all kinds of things. I mean, the summer is stocked with classical music, so you're going to have to shut me up if I go on too long. But we'll just start with the biggest story in classical music going on in these parts these days. Marjorie, you and I talked about this just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes,
Andres Nelsons.
That's right, the new conductor of the BSO.
Andres Nelsons, the new conductor of the BSO, really starting in September of 2014, but he's on the schedule for Tanglewood coming up on July 27th. So this is just a few weeks away. And he's going to be conducting one of the really great, massive pieces of choral music, really. It's the Requiem by Giuseppe Verdi, right? So there's going to be the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. This is just a spectacular. People joke around. They say that this is Verdi's best opera. It's not an opera at all. It's a Requiem. But it's written in such a
way that
you feel like this is an opera. There's drama. There's passion. This is Italian passion coming through on the Tanglewood stage. And what's really fun about this performance is that Andres Nelsons' wife is going to sing the soprano lead part. So her name is Christina Opelias. And they've worked together a lot, obviously, in, well, shall we say, many ways. But they're going to be collaborating right there on the stage at Tanglewood, along with another other guest soloist. But the piece is one of those pieces that is just Italian fire. So let's take a little listen to part of the Verdi Requiem. This is not Andres Nelsons conducting, but this is the flavor of the music that you're going to hear. ¶¶ So this is really fun.
Wow.
This
I want to go really conquer fun. Something.
And what's really fun, if you can manage to get to Tanglewood and get the right view in the shed, you're going to see this massive bass drum on its side. And you're going to see the bass drum player do a wind-up like Pedro Martinez. It just whacks the thing. It's so much fun. And, yeah. and there's a lot of tenderness in this piece as well. I mean, this is a very, very heartfelt piece that confronts death, right? But it's done with such Italian passion that... And now, so we have this passionate, fiery Italian piece in the hands of this fellow who lights a fire under every orchestra he's with anyway, Andres Nelsons. And he's the new guy at the BSO. The players
Call
are going to...
the fire department
the,
people.
The players are going to bring Woo. Their A game. The crowd is going to be fantastic. It's yeah. going to be just a spectacular night at Tanglewood.
When is this happening?
This is July 27th.
May I ask you a question about Tanglewood?
Yeah,
if,
yeah, yeah.
if you do not have the big bucks to get the great seats and yeah. you're in the cheap seats at Tanglewood, yeah. You're not
otherwise
get,
known as the lawn.
The lawn, right.
the cheap
it
lawn.
Is still an extraordinary.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's, okay. it, I mean, so if you're on the lawn and you, especially if you bring your blanket, your picnic, I mean, just pick up some, when I say picnic, just pick up some sandwiches at the convenience store and
right.
come on over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you sit out, and Tanglewood is one of the most beautiful physical spaces on the planet. It is just gorgeous. And so you'll hear the music certainly acoustically through the shed, but there's also amplification on the lawn too. So it's not the pure concert experience, but that's fine. That's
yeah.
that's what's so magical about it, is that you're sort of interacting with nature and the music and the people around you, and it's a really, really lovely
How
atmosphere.
How are the mosquitoes?
Well, you know, it gets cool out at Tanglewood.
Good.
Because we're up in the mountains, so they're not so prevalent. But, you know, but the event is the music, and so whatever the music happens, and of course there's a full season of Tanglewood. There's a Baroque concert. There's this choral concert. This weekend, we're opening with an all Tchaikovsky concert. It's going to be just wonderful. I got to say one more thing about Andres Nelsons. I mean, we've talked here about his reputation as a guy who's just filled with all kinds of interpretive excitement. I saw a tweet from a very, very well-known choral conductor in Britain. His name is Simon Halsey. And he tweeted last weekend that he prepared the chorus for the orchestra that Andres Nelsons conducts in Britain, the City of Birmingham Symphony. He tweeted, "I've prepared choruses for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony over 100 times. I've never experienced a performance more exciting than the one that
wow.
Andres Nelsons
wow.
conducted tonight."
I'm ready to wow. go. Come yeah. on, Marjorie,
wow.
we'll
so,
go.
So this is going to be a great era, we're hoping, for the Boston
this
Symphony Orchestra.
I think so. And we'll really sort of kick it off on July 27th.
That's exciting.
We're doing our summer music here with Rob Hochschild. I'm sorry.
That is correct.
From Berklee College Hochschild. Of Music. I know I'm a disgrace about this
Hochschild
kind of stuff.
In the house.
I'm a creature
Hochschild.
WCBR.
CRB, and that is.
CRB. Yeah. Oh, God. Falling apart.
Sorry, Marjorie.
Okay,
sorry, Marjorie.
I'll get this right. Edgar B. Herwick III, you are from WGBH,
that's
where
true.
I am also employed.
We sit right next to each other.
Yeah,
Marjorie.
We do. So what do you got for us?
Well, I'm going to be focusing in on sort of rock, pop, folk kind of stuff, the non-jazz and the non-classical. And my first pick for a concert is coming up on Tuesday. This is this Tuesday, and it's a great twofer on the bill. We've got two bands, one which is from New Jersey, and they're called Yola Tango. They've been around for a long, long time, and they're your sort of classic musical omnivores. They do everything from really kind of grungy, crunchy power pop to very twee kind of pop, very, you know, kind of happy and synthesizer-y and simple, to these long sort of guitar noise blasts and sort of everything in between. They're just a three-piece. It's a bass and a guitar and a drummer. The drummer and the guitarist are married, and they've been married for years, and they often
All
write
this,
about their relationship
this is
and love.
Just
and
so
man, music does it to you.
They're terrific. They're terrific. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not going to hear from them because
okay.
the other band is a band that I find to be even more terrific. So they're going to be playing along with a band called Bell and Sebastian, who are from Scotland. They've been around for going on 20 years now, and they kind of hit the scene in the early 90s, mid-90s, with a serious force. They sounded like nothing else when they first came on the scene. It was very literary lyrics that that seemed to kind of come from a high school journal, very considerate, a lot about sexual confusion. And
I have that.
Yeah. And then
she's not even in high school.
The combination of instruments was incredible because they had like a trumpet and a cello, but yet a guitar and a bass and a drum, and they really drove. And so I picked a song that we're going to hear a little bit of Belle and Sebastian here, which is from their first record. On this tour, they don't really have a new record out right now, so they're going to be playing from their entire catalog. I think that this song's really emblematic of their sound. This is going to be at the Bank of America Pavilion, so another outdoor kind of thing. This is Belle and Sebastian with a song called Expectations.
Knowing that you gotta go to school, tell your mom what to expect. She says it's right out of the blue. Do you wanna work in CNA? Cause that's what they expect. Move to lingerie and take a feel of you're the storeman. Tell Veronica the secret of the boy you never kissed. She's got everything to gain, cause she's a fat girl with a list. Sex up for you when you get aggravation from the snob, cause you can't afford to blaze a girl you're always wearing gloves.
I want to repeat again, you don't have to write all this down because everything is going to be on our website. Everything you're going to hear between now and 2 o'clock on WGBHnews.org/BPR. Why don't you introduce the guest, Susan?
Oh, yeah. Okay, Bill. Bill Ho... No. Rob Hochschild.
Hochschild. How about Hochschild?
Why is it? Does everybody do this to you?
Yes. Okay. You know what? I even mispronounce it and misspell it.
Oh, good. Okay.
It's okay. Don't worry.
Well, you're from Berkeley. You're doing the jazz. So what do you got now?
Well, what we have next up is something from, much as I tried to avoid any affiliation on one of these cuts, this is something from the Boston Summer Arts Weekend event, which is a Boston Globe WGBH event on Copley Square toward the end of this month. And the band I want to talk about is Preservation Hall,
yes,
jazz band. Now, there are a lot of great groups playing that weekend. And that night, you've also got Dr. John to complete the New Orleans thing that night and a couple other groups playing bluegrass and blues. But Preservation Hall Jazz Band, this is a band, if you've never seen them, if you've never been to New Orleans, if you have been to New Orleans, this is a free concert. You got to go and hear Dr. John and Preservation Hall. This is really American music. It's fun. It's improvisational. And it's unlike any other kind of music that you're going to hear coming out of people on new records these days, I think. That's actually not completely true because I think Edgar might have something to say about that. Anyway, this song has got...
The price is right for this concert, though.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Free.
It's... And even in New Orleans, you would pay to see the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. So we're going to listen to a tune called Bucket's Got a Hole in It, a little piece of this. Mm-hmm. The vocalist is Tuba Fats.
Great.
Everything that has any association with New Orleans sounds a little bit like it's drunk, right?
Yeah, right.
Just like sounds a little bit drunk.
You know, I saw Dr. John. Do you want to know how I saw Dr. John perform? I saw him open for Don Rickles, and the act in between was Pia Zadora. Okay.
Wow.
How about that?
God.
That's
just
a whiplash.
Think about that. You had
concert.
Dr. John, Pia Zadora, Don Rickles.
Who put that show together? David
Lynch? Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. What? That's amazing. You know, Rob and I were talking, before this, and I was talking about one of the concerts that I'm really excited about, which is kind of in the same vein. I'm not going to play music from it, but there's a band that's playing up here called Baby Soda Jazz Band. We've had them on Boston Public Radio before when they were in town before, and they kind of play in that Preservation Hall Jazz Band style. There's a handful of bands in Brooklyn that are doing that. But there's an event on Sunday, July 21st, which is happening in Ipswich, okay? And it's happening at the Crane Estate. Have you guys ever been to this?
Oh, yes. It's beautiful.
So there's a Roaring Twenties lawn party happening. Okay, so Baby Soda is going to be playing that. And the deal is that it's going to be on that beautiful, sprawling lawn. It's going to happen that Sunday afternoon. People are going to be dressed up in vintage gear. There's going to be vintage clothing dealers there. People are encouraged to picnic. There's going to be a swing dance lesson.
Wow.
It's going to be a full afternoon thing. This is kind of modeled on, this has been going on in New York City twice a summer, a similar kind of thing. It's been happening for a few years now. And a gang up here in Boston is modeling one on that. And if you just go on the web and search this stuff, these lawn parties, it's awesome. You see these people come in full vintage gear, bringing picnic baskets, and it's going to be a really cool event.
Love it.
A lot of people really excited about that. So that's kind of in the same vein. I just wanted to mention
that's
that.
That's great. Yeah.
Okay, Brian McCreath from WCRB.
Yeah, so there's a lot more going on with classical music as well, and I think that especially as we get into August, we're going to need some air conditioning. Mm. Right. So let me just make a suggestion for a particular building in Methuen.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Methuen Memorial Music Hall. But what's cool about this building is not just that it's air-conditioned. It's that it was built for one purpose, and one purpose only, and that is to house a gigantic pipe organ.
Wow.
This huge pipe organ was built for Boston Music Hall, which was downtown. It's where the Orpheum is now. I mean, in fact, the Orpheum is the old Boston Music Hall, just in a very reconfigured form. And that was the original home of the Boston Symphony. This gigantic organ was sitting on the stage there. And through the course of history, it was removed. The Boston Symphony built Symphony Hall. The thing was put in storage. And eventually this fellow said, you know, this organ is just too good to be laying around in a warehouse. He built a building in Methuen for this organ. And
jeez.
So now there is a concert series that goes on throughout the summer. They do events all year round, but there's a concert series that goes on throughout this summer. And in fact, this is the 150th anniversary year of this organ. So
really?
I know. Organ's a little off the beaten path, and we think of like, well, I don't want to go to church. But it's really, there's so much color and weirdness, frankly, that goes on with organ in a great way.
How long do organs typically last?
Oh, my gosh. They last for hundreds of
years.
They do. Oh, sure. Yeah.
So
hundreds of years.
So it's just a whippersnapper at 150 years
that's
old.
Right. That's right. It's one of those. It's another one of those European-American things. Yeah. Like, Europeans look at this like, are you kidding me? We have organs from 1600.
Yeah. Wow. We're like the L.A. of, you know, it's really old. It's from 1950.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So is that what we're going to hear?
Yeah. We'll hear a little bit of everybody's favorite organ music.
Oh.
And this is recorded on the Methuen Memorial Music Hall organ.
Get this out of like a 110-year-old organ.
No,
you don't get that bass.
And what you don't get out of radio speakers is the physical feeling of that low note running through your ribcage.
I can imagine. Right. I bet being there it must be
tremendous.
Yeah.
What
That's
is
awesome.
The movie you always see that you? What's the famous movie that?
Well, there's
plays
it comes up in Vincent Price movies
and
in Dracula.
Sure.
But the thing is that we just heard Bach. And that's the piece. It's the Toccata and Fugue in D minor. And that's kind of the first go-to thing we think of with pipe organ. But you have to also wrap in so many other composers that did amazing things with organs. And, you know, when you talk about organs, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but there are certain instruments meant for certain kinds of music. This organ can kind of do it all.
Wow. Mm.
So you're hearing, through the course of the summer, you're hearing music by Olivier Messiaen, this amazing 20th century French composer, and you're hearing Marcel Dupré, and you're hearing from William Walton, the British composer. I mean, there's every Wednesday night, there's a concert going on at the Methuen Memorial Music Hall on this organ. And what a great opportunity to just get out of the heat and just
cool.
get something that you don't get every day.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
With different organists?
A whole lineup of guest organists just coming. Because there's no regular organist for this hall. It's just like, okay, now it's your turn. And they come from out of town and from locally and everything. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right,
cool.
Edgar, what's next up?
All right, next up, let's go to festivals. There's all kinds of festivals, obviously. We've heard, you know, classical festivals, jazz festivals. There's a lot of rock festivals, a lot of them high profile. But one that I actually have not been as familiar with is something called the Nines Festival. And it happens in Devens, okay? And what caught my eye about this is the lineup. There's a couple things I like about this. One, it's a one-day festival, right? So I think it's cool that it's a one-day festival and you don't have to go, you know, figure out camping or spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars to get in. So that's really good. And two, they do something which is no overlapping sets. So one of the, you know, there's one kind of festival where there's like four stages and everybody gets a chance and that's cool, but then you got to kind of piecemeal your way through.
I hear
you. This thing, it's, you can see everything, you can go, and there's a bunch of bands that are playing that I think are going to be really good. Matt Pond, who's from a band called Matt Pond PA, NBA, Explosions in the Sky, which is a band from West Texas. If you've ever seen Friday Night Lights, either the movie or the show, that guitar-sounding music, that really kind of repetitive, reverb-laden music, that's all based on, or is, Explosions in the Sky music. So that's kind of the sound of them. Then a guy called Shuggie Otis is going to be there, who is an incredible musician from the 70s with an amazing story. And then a band that I really love from Philadelphia who are called Dr. Dog. And we're going to hear a little bit of Dr. Dog right here. These guys are the perfect band to see at a festival outdoors in the summertime. Here's a little Dr. Dog.
It sounds like David Bowie meets Sly and the Family Stone.
that's kind of it. I mean, they cast a wide.
Wow.
Sometimes they sound like ELO. Sometimes they sound like the Grateful Dead. Sometimes they sound like David Bowie. Sometimes,
you know, I'm feeling. I know this is that cuts from a couple of years ago, but I'm feeling a real 1970s, the best of. I'm not like Alan O'Day, Undercover Angel. I'm talking about some really good 70s stuff coming back. Like Daft Punk has
absolutely.
You know that disco song that's out right now.
Yeah. Well, it's the 40-year thing. The 30. Right. You know,
is that how long it's been?
There was a.
You know, if I had been alive in the 70s, I would have known.
You weren't even around.
In the 2000s, everybody was into psychedelia. Now that it's the 2010s, everybody's into the 70s.
Young whippersnappers.
Look out, 2020. Here come the 80s.
Okay, Rob Hochschild, Berklee College. You're up next.
Okay, we're going to go back indoors for this one to the air-conditioned Berklee Performance Center listen to a solo piano track coming up here from an artist by the name of Hayrim Gion. So after all this high-energy music we've been hearing, we're going to take it down a notch and listen to something that's going to calm you down after all that Dr. Dog kind of stuff. So this is a show at the Berklee Performance Center on July 24th. Hayrim Gion is a Korean pianist, and she's on the faculty at Berklee. This is a Korean folk tune called Ararang, and you'll hear influences like Bill Evans and Keith Jarrett. Really beautiful playing. He's just got a real delicate touch there.
You know, I hear people saying more and more that consumers are buying electric pianos. That's true, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because they're cheaper. How's the sound?
Oh, some of them sound fantastic.
They do.
You know, but you may wind up spending as much money on one of those as you would on an
Oh, really? I thought they were cheaper than like buying
at the entry level, I think they are, and they certainly take up less room, but
Is there anything like a piano, just both in sound, but also just the physical presence, right? Mm-hmm. You walk into a room or into a hall or wherever it is, and it's a centerpiece.
Well, those last a long time.
It draws you in.
Oh, huge, yeah.
I've got a 100-year-old piano.
My piano at home is 100 years old.
Yeah. Was it built in Boston, Chickering Factory?
No, it's very off-brand. That's the thing about a piano. This is a very off-brand. This was like mass production for the time, made in Albany.
Really?
Yeah, it's just an off-brand that's an upright piano meant for people's houses.
Before radio and TV, everybody had a piano.
Still,
that was your entertainment.
It's still hanging out in my house, and it's just my kids just bang on it all the time.
That was beautiful. I love that.
Yeah, that's great, too.
I love that, and I never heard that before, obviously. Okay, let's go on. We got a lot to fit in here.
Yeah,
we're running out of time.
Good.
So let's go.
Okay, so along with the Wednesday nights at...
You're Brian from WCRB. Excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So again, another series of concerts where the Price is Right is down on the Esplanade as the Wednesday night concert series with the Landmarks Orchestra takes place, right, in the Hat Shell. So these are free concerts every Wednesday. The Landmarks Orchestra with their conductor there will be doing all kinds of great concerts, but especially I want to draw attention to one concert that's going to come up. It's the last one of the summer on August 28th, and it is a tribute to the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech.
Oh.
So we'll have some music from various composers, including what some would say is the greatest American composer, and maybe if people are into classical music, they'll instantly think of Copland. Well, okay. But there's also going to be this beautiful, beautiful piece by another composer that some will argue is America's greatest composer. Rob, I think you're with me on this. Duke Ellington.
Oh, yeah.
Duke Ellington, one of the great American composers, also wrote for orchestra, believe it or not.
I did not know that.
And so there's this piece that he wrote called Three Black Kings. And one of the movements is dedicated to Martin Luther King. And so we'll just hear a little bit of that right now. This is Martin Luther King from Three Black Kings by Ellington.
Very different.
Yeah. You always think of Ellington, you think take the A train.
Yeah.
But the man was...
still kind of swings,
though.
But you
can hear it. Yeah, you can definitely hear it.
He's still working
it,
in his language, but the textures and his creativity really flow through this thing in a way that you don't expect.
And it's light. It's not, like, you know, it's like... Oh.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. I love this.
So one
who are the other two? We have one black king, of course, is Martin Luther King.
Oh, man, now
the
you're quizzing me.
It's okay. I just wonder why three black kings.
I was afraid you were going to do that, too.
That's okay.
But this is a really wonderful series outside, right on the Esplanade. Yeah. Beautiful stuff. All
okay,
summer
we got 6 minutes to go, guys. Give us your best stuff here.
All right, so... Well, I'm going to do this for Sue because Sue was talking about the best of the 70s, and I'm going to talk about another band that I think was one of the best bands of the 70s. That was a band called The Jam. Do you guys remember a band called The Jam from England?
Right, yeah.
Okay. And their lead singer, Paul Weller, who basically broke the band up in 1982 when they were at the height of their power. And this guy has continued to write songs in various forms. Mm-hmm. For years since, and he's had an incredible solo career. He's been named one of Britain's handsomest and most well dressed men over 50.
That's worth something.
But he's
pointing to me for
he's
over 50. What is that?
I was just pointing. I was just pointing, and you happened to be in the way. I was just pointing, and you happened to be in the way. Anyway, he has a new album out, he's coming to the Royale on July 28th. And I want to play I want to read this quote from him because I love the fact that we're doing this, this is what we call our concert roundtable. Here's something that Paul said about music. I've never understood the need to put music into boxes. To me, it all comes from the same source. I could listen to Debussy 1 minute, then some avant-garde jazz album, then Curtis Mayfield the next. And to me, it all comes from the same source. So that's the way he writes music. Here's a little taste of what he's up to now that he's not with The Jam anymore. Still rocking it. One of the things I love about Paul Weller is you really hear his British accent when he sings, which is not always the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it's an important thing in his music because his music is very British. A lot of his songs really capturing London in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s when he's lived there. So,
you know, when he opened for Dr. John and Pia Zadora. Actually,
you know, one amazing thing about Paul Weller is that he's so popular in England. He's like Elvis in England practically. And nobody in the States seems to know about
him. It's crazy. And he's done everything from sort of like acid jazz to krautrock stuff to
We have
pop,
to be like
to
an elitist. Like you talk about him and like, I know who Paul Weller is. That's sort of the, you know, in America.
Right.
But it is, you're right. That's good.
Should we do our Songs of America?
Sure.
Let's do that.
Okay. Go ahead, because we only got 4 minutes. We're counting down here.
All right, I'll go first. Songs for America. The tune that, for me, when Edgar asked us to think about this, I thought about a tune that just really captured the spirit of America. Of course, you think about freedom. And in jazz music, there's few composers that really encapsulate for me better than Charles Mingus. And he's a song from an album that came out in 1959. Mingus is the name of the album. The tune is Better Get It in Your Soul. And this just is the sound of freedom as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Woo. Yeah.
That's great.
Yep, that's America.
That's great.
There you go.
That's great. Okay, only because we're running out of time here, I want to go right over to Brian and get your Song for America classical end of things.
We are commemorating July 4th, right? The Revolutionary War. Every fight's got to have a fight song. And for us, it was Chester. Let's hear it. Forever reigns. Okay, so this is William Billings.
We're really specific here.
Generally,
not America's generally great, but New England.
England. The Boston-born William Billings, America's first great composer, who didn't even really write music. He just gave hymns to people, and they sang them with that gusto. And
God,
this fired up the troops with George Washington to go out and take
New
on
England.
The British.
That was very impressive. Okay, Edgar.
All right, so
Bean
for my pick, you know, I was going through my music catalog, and I was trying to come up with something like really obscure and perfect for the occasion. You know, that really kind of would surprise you and capture it. But in the end, I ended up landing on, of all songs, a song called America. And it's a Simon Garfunkel song. And to me, this captures America in specifically for a lot of reasons, but specifically because the idea behind this song is that there's a longing and that everybody and the title character is looking for America. The idea that America is, after all, an idea that people are trying to kind of get at. And this is a journey to try to get at that idea. And just one of the greatest songs, in my opinion, ever written. So here's a little of that.
Toss me a cigarette. I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago.
Okay, we're so impressed by this that we're going to go out on this little song here by Simon & Garfunkel, which is a great choice, Edgar B. Herrick. I want to thank you guys for coming in. This was kind of our concert roundtable for all the great music for this summer. I want to thank Edgar B. Herrick III from WGBH Curiosity Desk who picked this Simon & Garfunkel song. I want to thank Rob Hochschild. Yes.
Well done, Marjorie.
Thank you. The Berklee College of Music. I have been practicing this nonstop while I've been listening to music so I wouldn't embarrass myself yet again. And Brian McCree from WCRB Classical New England. Thank you very much, Brian, being with us.
You bet.
You can catch all of our panels' concert picks at our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. Thank you to Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and South End News, for sitting in for Jim Browdy, who's back on Monday. I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a great 4th of July. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio.